A context lecture's purpose is to either be meeting Christian leaders you're not otherwise going to meet, see Phil Johnson when he comes, or Nancy Piercy, who's coming this term, or it's an opportunity to get some background information from someone who knows what they're talking about, like a fire hose. So you can record it, we can put it online, and you can listen to it. That's a context lecture. People who write encyclopedia articles don't sell lots of copies of books. And so the problem, just warning you with tonight's talk, we have chosen to cover lots of material, maybe at the expense of being comprehensible the first time through, or even very interesting. On the other hand, background in ancient philosophy, everything I'm going to say is so superficial you'll want to throw things at me. Ah, how can he say that? Well, I could say more about most of these things, and one thing we'll do at the end is have lots of time for questions and answers which aren't on the tape. In some ways, we're making a tape of good basic background information, and you get to be the people here. And then after we're done doing that, we'll take lots of questions, and we'll even do questions during the talk, which I assume whoever's editing this can edit out, or we'll leave them up there, and you'll be immortalized as a moron. I was once on a... I've never done that to a question asker, but I was once with a very prominent Christian philosopher who teaches at this university on the platform, and a really little old lady toddled up to the front and asked her question, which consisted of, shouldn't we just love Jesus in our heart, and does the intellect matter? Doesn't that draw us away from Christ? And the prominent Christian philosopher leaned forward and said, your question is an embarrassment to the cause of Christ, which was true enough, but even I cringed. Ah! So I promise not to do that to you. If you ask a question that is in fact an embarrassment to the cause of Christ, I'll still sound like you're that's really an interesting question. And you'll know that it was a rotten one because I'll answer some other question you should have asked and not, like, isn't Yahweh way cooler than Zeus? The worst Tory freshman paper topic ever. If you don't already know that, okay. Here it is. Everything you should have learned about ancient philosophy in 10th grade, but maybe didn't. Unless you went to a better school than I went to. Well, if it blows up, that will be bad, because then we will have no PowerPoint, and I will see my cool slides, but you will not. The two big thinkers that form all of Western civilization, and we're going to use Western civilization as those places that have been deeply impacted by countries in Western Europe and what we now call Russia. Now, sticking Russia in there is a little controversial, but those countries that have been affected by the Judeo-Christian Greco-Roman synthesis. For most of human history, Greek and Roman thoughts and Jewish and Christian thoughts have been blended together in a synthesis of ideas that have deeply impacted the world. The culture produced by that is sometimes called the West. Now, if you think about it as geographic, you're going to miss my point altogether. The Anglican bishop of Kenya, who is a sub-Saharan African, is far more Western by this definition than the Archbishop of Canterbury. Even though, if you traced out their bloodlines, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's a Caucasian, is Western, if by the West you mean geography. He's from Wales, if memory serves me. You don't get much more Western than that. And the Archbishop of Kenya is a sub-Saharan African. So the West is an idea, not a race or a geography, in the way that I'm using it. And the West has been shaped by ideas from Jerusalem, supported through Judaism and Christianity for the most part, some Islamic influence, but not much. This synthesis is what produced the world that most people in the globe live in. So, for example, when I was teaching in Mongolia, which is about as far from the geographic West as you can get, The ideas that were important for people in Mongolia to understand the government that they were dealing with, the economy that they were trying to establish, were ideas from people like Marx, John Locke, Edmund Burke, the Declaration of Independence in the United States, the Constitution. Whether it's good or bad, these were the thinkers that they were wrestling with and that I had to describe. It didn't matter geographically where I was. Free people and free markets were what they were struggling with, whether those were good or bad, whether Republican forms of government were good or more command-control forms of government. One thing that wasn't an option was restoring the Khanate of Genghis Khan, who may have been a cultural hero, but his name was plastered on a hotel, very much built Western style engineering, and on a bottle of vodka which had been manufactured in a product of the Western Industrial Revolution. Restoring the Khanate and the ideas of the Khanate of Genghis Khan were an option. Now, not every good idea in the world is Western, and lots of bad ideas in the world are Western too, as we're about to see. So I'm not glorifying the West, perfect. But I am suggesting that for most places in the world, think China, still under the grip of communism, experimenting with capitalism. Many Western ideas are dominant. They're not the only ideas, they're not the best ideas, but they're the ones that are dominant currently in our global context. So understanding where they came from is important to understanding both where we've been and where we're going, wherever we end up in the ministry. And unfortunately, though multiculturalism is enormously important, we need to understand the diversity of God's and God's people. We also need to understand at least one culture well. And the problem with learning lots of things before you learn one thing is that you run the risk of knowing nothing very well, well enough to talk about it, to be comfortable inside of it. So without too much more justification, Tori focuses most of the 4 years you're here on helping you understand this long Western tradition that has produced modern medicine, modern science, and all the forms of government, with very few exceptions, Saudi Arabia is one of them, that are dominant on the planet. Iran would be another. But even in the Iranian theocracy, there are many trappings of constitutional democracy that come out of the West. So this is why we're doing what we're doing, why we're spending so much time. When we talk about Greece and Rome, then, we're talking about one of the roots of this Western civilization. It's not the same as Christian civilization. Whoops, let me go back. The other thing I'd suggest is we'll put all of this information on Bubs. Try not to spend lots of time just copying slides. Though I'll probably give you time to do that on some slides. Better to focus in trying to hear what I'm saying than just copying down every word on the slides when we're going to roll this information to you. This is just an attempt to put what I think is important on the board. This great Greece and Rome taproot, the two seminal first thinkers for this taproot were Homer and Hesiod. And they had lots of big ideas, and we're not going to explore many of them. We're going to explore some, the ones that have made a big difference. Now, I'm going to simplify everything tonight, lots, and one simplification I'm going to make is to say that for Greece, the struggle is essentially between the religious system centered in Delphi and Platonism, or philosophy. Platonism becomes the dominant philosophy, so we'll just talk about philosophy a lot as if it is Plato. Aristotle, very important thinker, particularly in the Middle Ages, but he had almost no disciples until the Middle Ages. His school of thought was not dominant during any period of Greek history, whereas Plato's thought became absolutely dominant and has always been a competitor in the West for a sensible way of looking at the world. So right away, I want you to think about Greece as being locked in a struggle before the coming of Christianity between a religious system mostly centered in a place called Delphi, whose Bibles were Homer and Hesiod, and the rise of philosophy, whose greatest exemplification was the man Plato, locked in a titanic struggle for dominance. Who won? this struggle? Anyone want to take a guess? Yeah, Delphi won. Philosophy lost. And we'll see how that happened and why that happened and how philosophy got co-opted. But let's look at the ideas of this root culture. Now, the reason I've spent time setting it up this way is that Christianity became the necessary tool to defeat the religion of Delphi. In fact, it destroyed Delphi physically. See Paul in Acts chapter 17. And if we have time, we'll look at Acts chapter 17 directly. Philosophy without theology was inadequate to defeat the shadow of that hideous strength that spread throughout the entire Mediterranean world, focused in the religious cult of Delphi. The ideas of Delphi were more powerful than the ideas of philosophy. It's only when philosophy gained the strength of a Jewish rabbi from Palestine named Paul that it was able to defeat the ideas that we find in Homer and Hesiod. If Christianity is defeated, then those nations, whether they're Kenya or Mongolia or Britain or the United States, that have dominantly been impacted by Western ideas, can expect a revival of the Delphic religious system. I don't have time tonight to prove it, but I believe it's the only real option to traditional Christianity. What are those ideas? First of all, that the universe, notice I didn't say cosmos, that the universe, that everything there is, begins in chaos, proceeds to cosmos, and then becomes logos. These are three important Greek words. It's like my big fat Greek wedding. Everything is a Greek word. And when it comes to science and lots of other areas, because the Greeks invented the way we think about them, lots of things are Greek words. You can't call the cosmos a cosmos if you're a Darwinist. Not really. What does the word cosmos mean? It means order or structure. Things have a purpose. What are your ears for in a cosmos? Hearing. What's your nose for? Your eyes are for seeing. Every kindergarten in the state of California is a Christianist institution. Johnny, what are noses for? Putting celery in. The teacher says, no, Johnny, that's not right. You shouldn't put celery in your nose. But see, if Johnny grows up and declares it his sexual preference, the state of California will protect him putting celery in his nose. Because at a high school level and further, everyone understands that the universe is not a cosmos, it's chaos. That things aren't for anything. And if you want to use your nose as a receptacle for celery, that's your call. So Homer and Hesiod begin with the assumption that if you scratch everything, if you plunge right down to the bottom, stuff doesn't make sense. Sense is something we impose on the universe, not something we find. Postmodernism, in most of its manifestations, is not new. It's simply a revival of the religion of Delphi in modern terms. So chaos is fundamental. What comes next? Out of what is fundamentally chaos, apparent order can arise. If I throw a bunch of marbles up in the air, they fall on the floor, they may, if I throw them up and down enough times, form an apparent order, like a triangle or a square. Out of this apparent order comes reason, logos. Divine reason. These are the very terms these thinkers use. Some of them are familiar to you from the Bible because the Bible was born in this discussion. The discussion that either in Johnson House or Morgan House, if you're a freshman, that you're beginning in Torrey, is a discussion that began with these terms. And that the biblical writers, particularly in the New Testament, which is written in Greek, picked up on and utilized in presenting the gospel. Second, gods are not fundamental. This is a fundamentally atheistic view of the world. gods arise out of chaos and cosmos. Remember, gods are reasonable, whatever you think of their reason. They reason. And so they are not creator gods, they're derivative. So in a Judeo-Christian sense of an omnipotent, omniscient creator god, Homer and Hesiod were atheists. We're not out there trying to convince people to be theists, folks. Theism is bad news, historically. The belief in the existence of gods. There's nothing good about thinking there's a god. If there's a god, how do you know he's any good? And if God looks like Zeus, wouldn't the universe be better if there wasn't a Zeus? I like to say, and many of you have heard me say, that in the ancient world, no one put "Smile, God Loves Me" on the back of their chariot. Because "Smile, God Loves Me" was a prelude to rape, not to an ecstatic worship experience. So why were there gods in the ancient world? There were gods solely so that we could explain why stuff seems reasonable, but also there's sort of excuses for evil. So gods are to be placated, not loved. You didn't want to hate the gods and you didn't want to love them, because if you got too much in the gods' face, they'd notice you, and noticing you was bad. Third, were the Greek myths true? Did the Greeks believe the gods lived on top of Olympus? Did they think the Trojan War took place literally as Homer said it? I can't answer that question. Because Homeric and Hesiodic Greeks didn't think that way. They would have said, well, that's an odd thing to ask. What about the story? Does the story work for you? Do you get it would be like going to the movie Braveheart, watching the film, and then having somebody come out and say, I've seen William Wallace's sword. It's 6 feet long. Mel Gibson could never lift it. No, William Wallace was well over 6 feet tall. Mel Gibson is about, what, 5'8"? They shoot him from the down up a lot. But you see, if you go to Braveheart and you're geeking out like that over Scottish independence, you've kind of missed the point of the film, someone might say. The point of the film is all the details of Wallace's life correct, or Bruce's, or anyone else's. It's to get the feeling and the emotion right. And that's the goal in the Iliad and the Odyssey. It isn't to explain how world works so you can build a submarine and go visit Poseidon. I mean, it's just asinine if that's what you want to do. Now, did an average Greek think Poseidon was probably down there if you built a submarine? I suppose if anybody had ever asked. But it would never occur to a follower of Delphi to ask that kind of question. Truth was less important than getting the story right. Now, this is not a dumb idea. Look at it this way. You can get all the words right when you want to ask your beloved to marry you. But if you don't get the sound right, the music right, you're dead. This is the woman that says to her beloved, but do you love me? And he looks at his watch and says, yeah, I told you I loved you. This isn't going to go well. Now think about the same words. I told you I loved you. Delivered passionately. I told you I loved you. And it can work. Now the question is, what if the guy said this? Does it really matter what he says if he kisses well? And that's the question between Homer and Plato. That's original to me. Does it matter what you say? This is the only time I've thought of me, and it's now on the internet. It's terrible. Does it matter what you say? This is really true. If you kiss well, if it feels right, Now, it's not dumb to say, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe words, words, words. Remember the song from My Fair Lady? Where she comes out and Freddie should just sweep her off her feet. And instead, he just wants to blah, blah, blah. And she says, words, words, words. Just kiss me. She's being Homeric. What did the world look like for Odysseus? The picture of the world, and notice, don't ask, did they think this was true? If you walked up to Homer and said, you know, the earth's a sphere. And by the way, by the time of Aristotle, everybody knew it was a sphere. The myth that people were worried about falling off the end of the world by the time of Columbus is just that. It's a myth. If you'd walked up to Homer and said, the earth is a sphere, he would have said, who cares? That the earth doesn't work well as a sphere. None of us live like the earth is a sphere. Every once in a while, we get on a plane and fly around, and then the sphericity of the earth. For the most part, we live as if the earth is flat, he would have said. My goal isn't to tell you the truth about the world, it's to tell you the truth about the world. My story, a flat earth, Middle Earth, this is where this term comes from, Lord of the Rings fans, suspended between heaven above and hell beneath, works mythically. Now, is it really that way? Probably most of the Greeks thought so. But they didn't spend much time thinking about it. That's a weird kind of question before the birth of philosophy. Is the music right? Not is the story true. I have a lecture online about Homer. That's about all I'm going to say about Homer and Hesiod. Let me stop and see if there are questions about this. These are the fundamental sort of that sets up. This is Delphi. This is the religion of Delphi. We'll say a few more things in a minute. Yes?
You keep talking about the birth of philosophy, and I can understand how it's played out around that time. It would be a birth of the pursuit of truth as a sort of dialectic or with rational absolute.
Yeah, it's earlier than that, and we'll see that in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got Homer and Hesiod presenting ideas that they're using as a philosophy. So why aren't you...
Yeah, no. Yeah, they're not a philosophy. This is very hard to understand. Well, it's not very hard to understand. It's just very hard to believe people thought that way. But it's where we're headed, and we're leaving behind a way that seems hard for you to imagine we could leave behind. When you think in terms of goodness, truth, and beauty, you're thinking within the realm of philosophy. Which is, I think, true, because I believe in a God who is good, true, and beautiful. But that is, after all, a hypothesis. Suppose that hypothesis to be false, and that it's meaningless, literally, to ask if something's good. By that you only mean, well, it's good to me. It's an expression of an opinion. Or whether it's true. That only means, it appears true to me. It's an expression of my opinion. Or if it's beautiful. It's not actually beautiful. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, not an idea in the mind of God. In that case, let me tell you a story to make sense out of your world. And how do you pick the story that you're going to tell? Does it work for me? It's the difference. If a couple of filmmakers in here, I see at least two. Yeah, it's the difference between making a movie to tell the truth. However, you know, you might cheat a little on the edges. You take poetic license. Even if you make the story up, hoping to tell the truth. It could be an ugly movie. The truth about camps. There's a film where I'm going to tell a story. My favorite example of this is A Fairy Tale. Anybody ever see the kids' movie A Fairy Tale? It's about two girls who find fairies in their backyard. And the movie, A Fairy Tale, is subtitled, A Fairy Tale, A True Story. Yet, the fairy tale is about two girls who are known frauds. They admitted in later life to going out and faking photographs of fairies and fooling a whole bunch of adults into thinking that they had taken pictures of real live fairies, not the San Francisco kind, but the kind that fly, not in airplanes. And everyone knows they're frauds. But the movie is made as if they really did it. And subtitled, a fairy tale, what? Well, at that point, what does truth mean? It's what the director wishes was true, and he doesn't really give a spit about what is truth. After all, what is truth? Truth is in the eye of the beholder. So let's rewrite history. Yes?
So basically, reason's out the window and rhetoric is the king.
That's right. Nothing wrong with rhetoric. Hopefully I'm saying what we're talking about tonight in an interesting enough manner that you can hang in there. But traditionally, it would matter to you that I've read actually Homer. And I'm basing the ideas, however generally I'm giving you, on what I read in Homer. Theoretically, in the Homeric world, I could just invent a Homer of my own imagination, and if it worked for you, then swell. So if we're obsessed, for example, with discussions about sexuality, as the modern university is, or about power and politics, the Iliad can be all about the war in Iraq. The Iliad has nothing to do with the war in Iraq. How do you know? Iraq didn't exist when the Iliad was written. Now, it may have a lot to say about warfare and Homer's take on warfare. But if we spend the whole class either praising George W. Bush or damning him, using quotations from the Iliad, we've created an Iliad of our own imagination and not the Iliad Homer wrote. Does that matter? The answer in the modern academy, or in the ancient academy, the Academy of Delphi, is no. What difference does it make? I mean, no one actually thinks Ajax went out and did all that stuff, right? So what is the story? Story's like a Rorschach test, right? What does it mean to you? What does it look like? Yes? Yes. Yes. That's why I can cheat meaningfully and just describe it all as Delphic. Because in the end, Delphic could subsume all of it because it's sort of a thought-out expression of what everybody who's not philosophical has to do in the end. Let's look at a couple of other things. That's a picture of Bacchus. Right away, Delphi recognized that there's a problem. Some people are, we're not going to get as far as I hope, but that's okay, super rational. They actually care about truth. People building buildings. And they had to build buildings, right? You have to build a building. You have to care some about rationality. So it isn't that these people are haters of rationality or method. It's just that they don't think they're ultimately true. Engineering isn't the truth, it's just useful. You see the difference? 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, it just works. So you don't have to say, oh, well, they were just stupid. No, they built cool things, go to the ruins in Mycenae. But they saw, look, some people, we'd say left-brained and right-brained because we're materialists. They'd say some people have rational souls and some people have erotic souls. And by erotic, I don't just mean sexuality. In Greek terms, it means passionate. They're really, you know, you can be erotic about food. You can be erotic about your country. You can be erotic about philosophy. I hope you're erotic about God. Many wonderful love poems to God. I love you, Jesus, written in the, love you, God, written in the Psalms. Or in Christian hymnody. So there's nothing wrong with erotica. They just recognize some people are guided by reason and other people by eros. So what you need, if Delphi's going to work, now which is good? Which is good? Reason or the erotic, if you're Homeric? It's a meaningless question. No, you've got to get this, folks. It's a meaningless question. There is no good. Now, sometimes it's good to party, sometimes it's good to build. When is it good? When you decide it's good. Which is true? Now you get the trick, right? So you can develop two alternative gods. One, Apollo, the god of light and reason. The other, Bacchus, the god of wine and parties. And you can simultaneously worship both gods because you're polytheist. And depending on the god you need, that's the god you worship. So that there developed a popular versus an intellectual religion. Look, we all know that the Homeric stories aren't true. But lots of doltish people who live simple lives, sort of on-off switch lives, drool cup people, and that's most people, I'm sorry, I'm talking the way they would have talked, need to believe stuff. So we'll just tell them it's true, even though we know it isn't, because it's too complicated to explain what I just explained to you. It would confuse the poor beggar. So soon, Greek culture became popular versus an intellectual religion. By the way, if you don't think this could happen today, look at liberal forms, and I mean theologically liberal, of Christianity, where the priest or pastor gets up on Easter morning and he says, "Today we celebrate the Easter event." And the little old lady in the front row, whose gifts pay for the church and his salary, thinks Jesus physically walked out of the church as the Lord. And the pastor is thinking, springtime is a great time. Rabbits breed. But he doesn't think a Jewish carpenter from Nazareth came out of a tomb. This story is only meaningful as a story of the inner spirit's conquest over darkness. And yet both of those people can be at the same church saying the same thing, Jesus has risen from the dead, alleluia, and they mean totally opposite things. The smart guy thing to believe is that Jesus did not physically rise from the dead. That's what he learned in seminary. The sort of idiot person takes it literally, and everyone's happy. Isn't this cool? In this way, Delphi could unify almost anything. And it all came down to worshiping the giant snake, Pythia, Python, which Apollo killed and then was somehow reincarnated in the person of the priestess Pythia at Delphi. As a Christian, you should find it intriguing that Delphi centered in the worship of a snake. But there you go. The problem with the gods is they're kind of rotten. Have you noticed that? So every once in a while, you want to claim the gods are good. And you can do that by telling zillions of alternative stories. Every town can have their alternative where their town god is good and everybody else's god is bad. And Delphi doesn't care because nobody believes any of the stories are true anyway. So to us, that seems confusing. I already taught a class today where people are saying, oh, well, we have these like alternate traditions. And what's the true story of the birth of Zeus? No, there is a true story of the birth of Zeus. Zeus isn't real. Zeus is a construct of a bunch of Delphic priests to describe the Python force that they're worshiping. Now, if you believe in your local Zeus, Zeus of Colonus, and tell lots of stories about how he's born, we may even eventually develop a common oral tradition that becomes written down, see Homer and Hesiod, and so we widely share it. But it doesn't matter so much whether our gods are good as long as you think they're good in your town, your local god. Next, we have some gods that make sense to reason, and whenever we need to think, we'll do it. Delphi becomes dominant. You have no idea how dominant. Pharaohs of Egypt sent money to the Pythia, who would sit over a crack in the earth on a tripod. And from that crack, smoke arose. And she would breathe it in while chewing on the leaves of a laurel tree and began to utter ecstatic prophecy. And the priests of Delphi would interpret that prophecy, and on their words hung the fate of nations. For hundreds of years, the wealth of nations poured into Delphi. Dominant. with other temples like that of Delos and the religions of Egypt that became associated with Delphi, Delphi and the Mediterranean world subsumed the religious rabbi in one giant Homeric worldview. And it worked. Eventually, by the way, say one other thing, they developed what became known as the Bacchic cults. If you're reading Euripides this semester, you'll run into these cults. The Bacchic cults satisfied people's craving for mystery by developing elaborate rituals. Think about the Masons in our modern culture, that themselves meant nothing but were highly erotically charged, and by that I mean sexually charged, and ultimately usually led to a sort of temple prostitution where you became one with your god through sexual relations, or you became one with the god by eating, while it was alive, a sacrificial animal to that god, or by laying in a pit and having the animal killed over you so that its innards fell on top of you, or crawling into a cave, which is between hell and Middle Earth, or going to the very top of a mountain, which is between hell and Middle Earth, but particularly caves, because they were like wombs, ingesting drugs and tripping to have a relationship with your god. Sometimes sexual, sometimes not. This became a sort of fun overlay on top of Delphi. So far as we know, it never included human sacrifice. The Greeks did not believe in human sacrifice. Now, you need to understand this because philosophy arises in contradistinction to it. And it's probably the part of the talk that you couldn't have heard somewhere else. Thoughts? It's where the world's headed. I hope you can tell. Yeah. Right.
I thought the Iliad, it was all chaos because it begins and ends in war and nothing's resolved.
The way it would go, right? Chaos is fundamental. Yeah, I'm sorry, I said something badly, Fadagati, if you heard me this way. I didn't mean to imply that things go from chaos to logos as much as cosmos and logos come out of chaos, but if you scratch underneath, logos really just is a sort of cheesy chaos. It's not real. It's a manifestation of the chaotic. You're not real. You're matter and energy and mindless motion. Yes?
Would the Homeric worldview kind of be the ultimate relativistic worldview?
Yeah, it's not even meaningful to call it relativistic, because there's nothing to be relative to. It's like asking, oh, where do I disagree with Homer? You can't disagree with Homer. Homer will subsume anything you think. If you had shown up in Homeric Greece and said, Jesus is Lord, they would have said, great, good, Jesus is Lord. Jesus is the only God. Sure. Uh-huh. Let's set up a shrine for him. How much can we charge? Let's ask the Pythia and see what she says. Yeah, you see how this works? You just can't. No yes, no answers. Yeah. It's how to look smart, by the way, in Christian colleges. Too many Christian college faculty are Homeroids. I view Tori as the preparation H of our culture, destroying the Homeroids. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Some, but not a lot. It's kind of gross, and most people don't hang that way. Yeah. The fact that you would ask makes us all wonder about you. No. I'm sorry, I'm giving you a hard time. Yeah. Hide the dogs, folks. I like a dog and a cat. You can't come to our house, man. Yeah.
Should we presuppose any type of worldview before we go into it, like a Christian worldview or
No, but it's extraordinarily dangerous, and I go into it prayed up. That's why we're talking about this, right? You don't read a book like Homer and assume, oh, this is just bogus. For a long time, it was safe to read Homer because the worldview was so unappealing to most Westerners that they weren't tempted by it. Delphi was long forgotten. There was a Christian Greek town with many churches. Somewhere in the 19th century, we tore down the Christian town, and we've rebuilt Delphi. You can go look at it. And there's a functioning, New Agey kind of UN community there. It's worth seeing if you go there. But it's not something now we should play because we're again in a cultural period to us where the Iliad makes sense and isn't adopt this. This is just full of despair. In a Christian household, that may still be enough for you. You may actually be pretty safe. But if you have to watch a lot of film like I do, because I love film, and you have to be in our culture a lot like I do, and like I think you should be eventually, then you better go prayed up when you read Homer, because all of us have chinks in our armor where Homeric ideas have started popping out again. Yeah. Of course, you could ignore the oracle if you didn't like it, and often the oracle cheated. You know, famously, it told one emperor that if you invade, a great empire will be destroyed. You know, it's that one of those wonderful two-edged prophecies that can cut either way, no matter what happens. But the oracle didn't always work that way, and since I'm not a naturalist, I have no reason to believe that they weren't in touch with some kind of real power. Now, I don't know that, but I strongly suspect it. It is interesting that at the time of the coming of the Christ, the most authenticated fact of human history, the smoke that rose from Delphi, disappeared and no trace of it exists to this day. The coming of the Christ mattered. Virgil. Yes. No. Why do you keep asking about purpose? See, was it Homer Group that kept trying to find a theme to Homer? I was just going mad. I thought, I must get to tonight's lecture. Must stop students from saying stupid AP English things. No, I mean, you can't ask for a purpose. There is no purpose. There is no purpose.
Why do you address it,
though? Why do we address what?
Rage or any emotion.
Oh, because it's there. Have you ever felt rage? Have you ever been harmed by rage? Do you need rage to fight a war? Is rage useful? So let's understand it in its own terms. Let's not try to figure out a purpose or what it all means. Go away, you Christian. Yeah.
Did anyone like Homer actually live out that way?
Yes.
Like, thinking that there
yes.
Was nothing that
most Christians live this way, in my opinion. It's, in fact, an easy way to live. Most of you don't behave as if purposefulness were true. I don't, mostly, if I'm not careful. We just live like beasts. How hard is it to live that way, non-reflectively? If the unexamined life isn't worth living, there's sure a heck of a lot of people who are living unexamined lives who think their lives are worth living. The philosophical life is difficult. It's not natural to fallen men. Is it? People in your dorms tonight aren't sitting reasoning about what they should do, for the most part. They're probably either doing what they were told, that is, living in a functional Homeric monarchy, whose monarchs are professors, or they're doing what they feel like, whether that's conforming or not conforming. They're either sheep or random. Now, hopefully, many people at Biola are also living examined lives. Yes, and then we need to move on to the birth of philosophy. Sure, I have no reason to... I don't doubt people's religious experience. It's a bad apologetic move to say our God, nobody else's, is real. Traditional Christian apologetics didn't do that. I don't go up to a Mormon friend and say, oh, you didn't have a real religious experience. You haven't really met the divine. This is a spiritual book. I pretty much accept that when people say they have spiritual experiences, what are they having? Spiritual experiences. The question is, what'd you run into? You stick a fork in an electric outlet, it's possible that you'll become Einstein. Or you can become dead. Somewhere in between those options, there's what's likely to happen to you. Now, if you stick a fork into the supernatural world, good stuff may happen to you, bad stuff may happen to you, and how you interpret that stuff, that's up in the air. The question is not whether Christians have religious experiences, we do, but whether our interpretation of those experiences is correct, or whether Hindu interpretations or Muslim interpretations are correct, or whether the Homeroids are essentially right, and that religious experience itself and the supernatural world with the natural world are just part of the big chaos. It doesn't mean anything either. So instead of trying to explain it, you try to avoid it as much as possible, since power usually harms, it doesn't help. Natural power, left unchecked. Religion is a kind of toxic thing. Okay, the first philosopher is named Thales. We actually know exactly when philosophy was born. It was born in 585. How can I say that? Because Thales predicted an eclipse, and we know when the eclipse was. Now, the fact that Thales could predict an eclipse is not why philosophy was born. The Babylonians, using religious means, had been able to do that for hundreds of years. The fact was that Thales explained the eclipse rationally, by which I don't mean materialistically. It means he thought of the universe in an ordered way, so that his explanation for the eclipse depended on reason and order, not on merely noting when it happened before and predicting it would happen again. Do you see the difference? It isn't philosophy and it's not science if what you do is say, well, it usually happens this way, so we think it's going to happen that way again. That's just good thinking of the basic sort, and Homer people could do that. You stick someone in the belly with a bronze sword, their guts spill out, they die. Every 100 years, let me make up a number, we have an eclipse. 100 years have happened. What's going to happen? We're going to have an eclipse. We don't try to explain it. We don't try to make sense out of it. We just note it's going to happen. It's springtime, it rains. Thales failed, but tried to explain the eclipse. Not just note it was going to happen. And he did it by looking for a basic supernatural and natural arche for the world. Now, the reason I wrote a Greek word is not because I want to show you that I know Greek words. It's because there's no good translation for the Greek word arche. It sort of means the beginning or the starting point. But if I say that, you'll think about a race. On your mark, get set, go, where you take off. Thales wanted to get rid of the chaos at the bottom. Remember that in Homer? Everything, if you scratch it, is chaos. He wanted to build a basement. And he needed some stuff to make basic so that the universe could be orderly at the bottom. A cosmos first. And to do that, he needed a sort of backbone, spine, rib cage, if you will, or basement for the universe. That's an arche. By the way, John chapter 1, verse 1. In the word, it's not beginning linearly, though it is that too. It's fundamental. Was the Logos. Logos doesn't mean just word. It means reason, logic, things, act along that line. that columns long in the Liddell and Scott Greek lexicon. It's a powerful word in the history of ideas. Thales thought water was the arche. That's not important for you to remember. It's cool. He thought it was water because water's in so much stuff. And it seems to be able to do everything. That's wrong. But there you go. Next philosopher worth looking at is Anaximander. He lived around 550. These people all lived in the Ionian part of Greece, what we would today call Turkey. Most of Greece used to be in what we now call Turkey until the Turks killed most of the Greeks there. Anaximander is important. There's a nice little picture of the view of the earth. Don't bother writing it down or trying to memorize it. You're not philosophy majors. If you are a philosophy major, you'll someday have a class where you have to think about this. What I want you to notice about Anaximander is he tried to explain the earth and the appearance of the sun without just telling a story. He tried to tell the truth about the sun. Now, his story is kind of crazy. He believed the stars and sun are fires trapped in globular masses by cooler air. A nozzle or vent of sun facing towards us is what we actually see in the sky. Now, we could go into why he wanted to think that. It explains certain problems if you have a flat earth. It's hard to make the sun work with a flat earth. And so he could fix those problems by this elaborate sun mechanism. The point isn't that this idea... It is that Thales and Anaximander could have an argument. People cared whether they were... because they thought they were telling... because they were looking for... an arche on which to hang the logos. Next, we have Anaximenes. Again, just we're going to fly through these names. They're all going to turn into a blur of A names, and that's fine. Anaximenes turned the sun into a leaf-like thing that floats, you know, the earth floats on air. The big question was, if the earth is flat, what's it sitting on? And Anaximenes said, oh, it's sitting on air. It doesn't drop because there's infinite air on either side of it. So it just hangs there. There's no place for it to go because one place is the same as the other. That's kind of a cool idea, right? Not unlike our idea of space. And the sun doesn't set below the edge, but is obscured by high mountains at the edge of the earth. Again, this was an attempt to make sense of the motion of the sun with a flat earth. Now, what should they have done? What will they do soon? Get rid of a flat earth and adopt a sphere. It's easier to make sense out of stuff you see, like ships sailing away that sink under the horizon instead of just getting smaller and smaller. But they're still to make sense of the earth. What I want you to see is that they're in a discussion. Look how close these people live to each other. Right? There's schools of thought that are having arguments. And this is totally un-Delphi-like. What did by the way, the arche for Anaximander was something he called the indefinite. That didn't go very far in philosophy. Error for Anaximenes, not surprisingly, because there was so much of it, was the indefinite. Our favorite philosopher in this stream is Heraclitus. Because he's the next guy that it's actually worth remembering as you read Plato and other people. This discussion had reached a kind of dead end by the time of Heraclitus. They've been working on it for about 50 years. Not a lot of progress is being made. Heraclitus was an annoying fellow. He was one of those philosophers who only spoke, so far as we know, in epigrams, like a Tory tutor gone bad. Sort of, the way up is the way down. His most famous epigram is, you can never step in the same river twice. Which for some reason in the film Pocahontas starts singing in the middle of a forest. When I went to see it with my little kids, I was sitting in the theater and I started yelling, Heraclitean philosophy! And my wife was beating me and telling me, I couldn't figure out how Pocahontas... It's It's amazing. No wonder she thought that not hearing the wolf cry to the blue corn moon mattered. I mean, it's just, it's amazing. Heraclitus decided fundamentally, he said, now we're trying to make the supernatural, the intelligent world, and the natural world hinge together with one substance, water, air, the woo, indefinite, and this isn't going real well. Stuff, that's right, earth, fire, sometimes, Aristotle picks up on and does something with it, but we'll leave it alone for now. Heraclitus said, we're trying to explain too much with too little. We need a natural arche, and then married to it, an intelligent arche. We're going to have God, the divine logos, which is the arche of the world, who utilizes fire to produce the world. Fire is the physical arche. So, in the beginning, said Heraclitus in the city of Ephesus, which is where he was from, was the Logos. And the Logos was a great God. It is the greatest God. And that's the way the cosmos works. I hope that sounds familiar. Sounds like the beginning of John, almost word for word. Where did John write his gospel in all probability? The city of Ephesus. He was the next most famous resident of the city of Ephesus. Heraclitus, think of you can never step in the same river twice, believed that this divine logos provided the frame for a river. You can never step in the same river twice because the water's always flowing. I should have brought the song with me, right? It's just always going by. But you can step in the same river twice in a way because the banks don't change. Now, they really do, but it's an analogy. You get the point? The logos doesn't change. Everything else does. In this way, Heraclitus could account for constant change that really does exist. Even mountains made of granite get smaller with time, while still not falling back into the Homeroid or Delphic picture of chaos as fundamental. Heraclitus rules. Everyone says, man, this division between intelligent causation and natural causation, natural things are caused by fire, intelligent things are caused by logos, this solves all our problems. When Michael Behe or Bill Dembski do intelligent design work, they are simply following in the train of Heraclitus of Ephesus, who is, by the way, not a fundamentalist Christian. The next time your friends tell you that intelligent design is a fundamentalist Christian plot. You have a question back there? Go for it. Okay, keep thinking. We'll see what we can do. Yes. What's that?
What is an epigram?
It's a little short, pithy saying. You can never step in the same river twice. He liked this one, war is peace. It's Orwellian, right? Now, but he wasn't a nut. What he was doing is saying, look, it looks like things are chaotic, but they're really not. The way down is the way up. You start going down, but when you get down, you find the divine logos, and that you see the face of God. What's basic is divine, and you have to go down into the ground to find it, not up into the sky. And that kind of makes sense. He was trying to provoke thought, provoke philosophy. Yeah. He also was a giant jerk, and no one liked him. And because he felt superior to everyone, sort of like a Tory student gone bad, right? The freshman Tory student who runs up to his friends and says, I'm reading Homer. What are you reading? To which the response is usually like the Bible or something. Inferior. And so Homer, Heraclitus believed that what was the basis to life? Can you guess? Yeah, heat. Dead things are cold. Living things are... And when you get sick, what often happens to you? you overheat and sweat and stuff. So Heraclitus believed that when you got really sick, you should be heated up more. Now, the problem with this theory is the only way the Greeks had to heat you, apparently, was to put you in a fire. And that kind of doesn't work very well because you tend to die before the fire can help you. It's like too much fire. It's like drinking too much medicine too quickly. Your body can't handle it. So he noticed a cool thing. He noticed on a cold day that steam would rise up from fields and farms. And that if you put too much manure in a barn, it would catch fire from the heat and burn down the barn. What if you packed a patient in manure? It would heat up their body and they'd get better. So there weren't a lot of volunteers for this as a plan. So when Heraclitus got really sick, he had his disciples bury him in cow manure, thus becoming the first philosopher to ever die in his own BS. No, this is true. I wish I were making this up just for that punchline, but it's true. The whole thing about air, however, had escaped his worldview. So the sort of lack of air killed Heraclitus. We'll never know if they'd put a straw there if, in fact, he had gotten better. So I suggest you try. This is a good freshman project for a Tory thesis credit. Let's move on. Pythagoras, next big thinker. Did Pythagoras exist? No one knows. Pythagoras became one of those thinkers that everybody liked to attribute everything to. If he existed, he lived in southern Italy. The Pythagoreans who came after him surely did exist. But he's in such a legendary past, by the way, compare that to Jesus, that nobody can answer this. Jesus we know lots about, Pythagoras we know nothing about. Pythagoras made a cool discovery, and I'll just talk as if he existed. The people who followed Pythagoras made a cool discovery, and it changed the whole Greek world. You're kind of thinking about Heraclitus and this divine logos, and they discovered something cool. If you take a string and you pluck it, it makes a noise. Right? Harps. Nothing new about that. What happens if you cut the string in half? Yes. That's really weird. Math works. Why should it? Math is totally abstract. Numbers don't exist. Things like the Pythagorean theorem, which they did indeed invent in the school of Pythagoras, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, are totally dealing with abstract objects. They were not developed to do anything. They were developed as purely mathematical models. But then they work in the real world. And music freaks everybody out at the time of Pythagoras. Because music turns out to be, and notice no one knew this before, mathematical. You can mathematize music. Right, musicians? It's God. God. God's calling. Oh, the whole music thing. And second, you can musify math. A series of equations, you could turn it into a score. And the real world can be understood mathematically. Ah! And music, think about a musician. You're doing this rational thing while you're feeling and doing something. Head, heart, hand. This is why in Tory we often suggest that music is the highest discipline. And that no one can be well-educated who's not a musician in one form or another. Because from this point on, this was widely believed and has been accepted in the Christian West ever since. Music was therefore taken to be fundamental to creation. If you could hear it, there was a song to creation. Why can't you hear it, by the way? Because it's like the fan that's going on in the background that I just pointed your attention to. It's so constant, you can't hear it. And if it stopped, you wouldn't exist. It's the music of the spheres. And that's the beginning of this idea. This is so deeply embedded in Western culture that when I was a little boy in Sunday school, I would sing my favorite hymn, "This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature rings and round me sings," what? And in my little West Virginia church, we were doing Pythagorean philosophy without knowing it. When J.R.R. Tolkien creates the world in his Silmarillion, he has Ilúvatar do what? Sing the world into existence. Now, is this true? Who knows? But Western Christians have long believed it was true because of the convergence of theology, mathematics, and reality in music. This is why ugliness in music has often been considered the forerunner to the destruction of a culture, whereas beautiful music has been considered a good sign for a culture, whether true or not. Musicians have always been taken enormously seriously because they speak an alternative language that can be transcultural in ways that language cannot be. One way of looking at the Republic or Dante. Dante may be a giant motet. Those of you who are musicians, I'll leave you to explore that. The Republic may be a giant score of music in its own right as well. The Pythagoreans, very serious people, had a big impact. Well, here's their notion of the universe. The next time somebody tells you that everybody believed the earth was the center of the universe in the ancient world, you can tell them that that's just a lie. The Pythagoreans had good reason to think that there was fire in the center of the universe, but they didn't think the sun should be there. Now, the reason for that is an important one. When I was your age, I was taught in school that Christians opposed heliocentrism because they wanted the earth to be the center of the universe because being in the center is cool. And moving us out of the center of the universe would make people less important and somehow mess up the Christian story by putting us, you know, in a little planet circling the sun. Am I the only one who ever heard something like that in school? Yeah, that's incredibly false. Now, you know it's false just by knowing something about the Pythagoreans. Why wouldn't the Pythagoreans put the sun in the center of the universe? Because they liked the sun, they thought it was a god, and things in the center of the universe were bad. Pre-gravity, the best explanation for why things fell was that like, this big thing in Greek thought, you have to understand all the books you're reading if they're ancient Greek, like is attracted to like. Earth is attracted to Earth. Why do things fall then? What's this mostly made out of? What are the four elements? It's not hard to guess. Earth, fire, water, or air? Earth. You drop it, it falls, because where's most of the earth? Down. By the way, where's most of the fire in the cosmos? Up, which is why fire points up when you burn it. What does water do? It heads for other water. If you pour it out. It's not a stupid idea. In fact, it explains a lot. It's wrong. There are better explanations, but it really works. You can go a long way with this notion of like is attracted to like. If you take this view of the cosmos, then down the center is where all the heavy, dense things, the earthy things, congregate. And because the Greeks came to believe that the finer things are what you could use to reason with, dense stuff is hard to move. The earth came to be seen as the giant garbage pit of the universe. It's where all the earthy stuff went. We're standing at the bottom of a well looking out at heaven, where all the fire and the cool air are. The reason early Christian scientists didn't like heliocentrism wasn't because they had an elevated view of the earth or they thought the cosmos was small. They knew it was huge. Huge. It's because they didn't want to put the earth with sinful human beings in heaven. It's the opposite of what you were taught in school. And this is why the Pythagoreans put a sort of hearth or flame that wasn't the sun in the center of the universe. Because they didn't want to put the sun there. It was unworthy. They elevated the earth. They also believed in what was called counter-earth. They believed there was an opposite of the earth that was always on the other side of the fire so you couldn't see it, where everything was the opposite of what we have on this planet. It makes for good science fiction, but it's not true. I know some of you are disappointed. A couple other philosophers, and then we'll be done. We're not going to be able to finish, and I'll take questions. Another early philosopher you should know, at least hear about, is Empedocles. Empedocles invented evolutionary biology in the sense of survival of the fittest and natural selection. Both of those ideas are found in Empedocles' thought, but it's a theistic evolutionary biology. In other words, he believes there's a divine logos undergirding everything, and there is a constant battle between what he called love and strife. And love keeps making things, and strife keeps breaking it down. And how do you get animals? Well, you start with monsters, and he actually pointed to fossils. Look at these fossils. These are awful, ugly things. And the fossils, like an eyeball gets formed in the ocean, and it rolls into another, like, head. And you have this sort of one-eyed monster, but it's pretty ugly, and it doesn't survive. And so then you get another one that's more hopeful. They sort of collide, these parts that love is creating, until you get one that works. And what works survives. That's Empedocles, around the middle of the 5th century. That's around 450. Now, there are no planets in Empedocles' thought, just polished rings. Now, I'm not going to go into why he thought that. I just want you to see they're having big arguments. Meanwhile, in Delphi, what are they doing? Telling stories. Science isn't possible in a Delphic religion. All of this happy work was destroyed by a philosophical insight by the anti-Heraclitus named Parmenides. And at this point, we'll be able to stop because we've gotten to Socrates. Parmenides kills the birth of philosophy, but he hates all of this and is opposing it with all of its power. Parmenides thinks of a problem that is so difficult to solve, philosophers are still working on it. He says, is, cannot, not be. That's his big insight. But if you believe that, it destroys change and motion. If a thing is, then it is. And can something come from nothing? No, nothing can come from nothing. Really nothing. And if something is, it can't be nothing, so it can't have come into being. So whatever is always was and always will be. Because for it to become not would mean something would have to become nothing, but something is something, not nothing. And the same thing is true of change. Now, Parmenides understood that that sounds stupid, right? Just, well, okay, that's the kind of thing philosophers are always saying. Actually, it wasn't the kind of thing philosophers were always saying until Parmenides. And I understand, I know it's time to go, LD, just a bit. I understand how that makes no sense. So his disciple, Zeno, developed puzzles to demonstrate that it's true. Seems to be true or not. For example, Achilles is racing a turtle, and the turtle is given a 1 mile head start. Achilles can never catch the turtle. Why? The turtle is a mile ahead, and to catch it, Achilles has to run half a mile. And then he has to run half of half a mile, right? And then half of a half of a half a mile. And then, how many points are between Achilles and the turtle? How long does it take to cross an infinite number of points? Achilles will never catch the turtle. And yet Achilles does catch the turtle, which means reality is an illusion, change is impossible. You're a dream. You're not real. Nothing is real. The universe is just one big solid ball of is. This was disturbing to a lot of people. people began to Delphi was looking a lot better to a lot of people. The genius of Plato was to accept Parmenides as being right. That which is cannot be. And Heraclitus is right. Everything changes. And solve the riddle. He accepted that being cannot change, and that becoming exists, and that nothing comes from nothing, and created a sensible, rational worldview out of what seemed to be impossibility. Which is why all of Western philosophy is either Platonist or a reaction to Plato. Because he rebirthed philosophy from the pit that Parmenides had left it in. He allowed for science by creating a world of becoming, a Shadowlands, see C.S. Lewis, The Last Battle, that was not real, because in reality, nothing could change. And reality was God, who was changeless, eternal, omnipotent, omniscient. And so there you go. Now, whether Plato believed God was that great good which towered over all of them that changed not. Delphi reacted by killing Plato's teacher, Socrates. I don't have time to look at Socrates right now. And forcing Plato to write cryptically when he wrote philosophy, which is why when you read Plato, it's hard to know what he's saying until you get the key. It's extraordinarily deep and clever and subtle, so that the people of conventional religion could read it and not understand it. Plato's titanic was waged across several continents. He was the smartest man who had lived up to that time. He was a ferociously great writer, a profound intellect, and building on the work of the philosophers that came before him, he went to war with Delphi. And while he lived, he kept a free and autonomous intellectual tradition going. And his student Aristotle, who investigated the scientific world and who agreed with Plato more than he disagreed with him, also kept that tradition alive. But after Plato and Aristotle, Platonism was co-opted by Delphi and became Neoplatonism, a religious worldview that owed more to Homer than it owed to Plato. And Aristotelianism was essentially forgotten. And the scientific work of Aristotle was made nothing. And then one day, in Athens, the center of the Greek intellectual world, there came a very small, if history is right, short, bald-headed man who strode into Athens and did not go to the Acropolis, where the temple of the Parthenos, the great virgin goddess, looms over the entire city, that center of the Homeric religion. Nor did he go to the marketplace where Socrates and Plato had birthed philosophy. Instead, he stood on a small hill made of solid stone, dedicated to the god of war, Mars Hill, the Areopagus, the hill of Ares. Between the Homeric gods and philosophy in the Agora. And he said this, "Men of Athens, I perceive that you are very religious." And the text says that he was talking to a group of people, the Cynics and the Epicureans, who had accepted the fact that there are no gods, and who had bought into the dual smart people's religion, dumb people's religion. And Paul said, "I see idols everywhere. You're very religious." And he stuck a knife to them. What could they say? Just as he had split the Sanhedrin by talking about the resurrection of the dead, knowing that the Sadducees didn't believe in it and the Pharisees did. So he stood at the point of Delphi and said, oh yeah, here are all these idols. Oh yes, by the way, we know that Heraclitus said that idols are junk. We know that your own Stoic and Epicurean philosophy deny the existence of the Greek pantheon, but you go on pawning it off on the people of Athens. And then he quotes one of the most obscure Stoic philosophers to show that he got it. That he wasn't just stupid and he didn't know what the Stoics believed. He says, oh yes, all men are brothers. But I have some good news for you, he said. What? The very thing that Plato could not see, which is how to bridge the world between becoming and being. How to bring the world of ideas together with the world of becoming. Paul told them. He said, in the words of John chapter 1, verses 1 through 14, not that there was a God and a divine arche. They already knew that. But that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father. What He proclaimed on Mars Hill was that God became man, died, and then God raised Him from the dead. And the ancient world was destroyed. It was an idea so powerful and so perfect for what they had needed to hear, that even the non-Christians adopted it with different language. Brothers and sisters, there can be no reason without the incarnation of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. If the Word does not become flesh, then there is no guarantee that even the language you speak will work. The alternative is the chaos of Delphi. Paul stood with Plato and completed him, and the world was changed. Isn't that good news? I hope that's some interesting background information to help you. Let me take two or three questions, and then we need to go.